Hello, everybody. Mark Carlson here, SNEA Technical Council Chair. Welcome to the STC Podcast. Every week, the STC Podcast presents important technical topics to the developer community. Each episode is hand-selected by the SNEA Technical Council from the presentations at our annual Storage Developer Conference. The link to the slides is available in the show notes at snea.org/podcast. You are listening to STC Podcast Episode 34. Today we hear from Matt Kurjanowicz, Senior Software Engineer Lead, and Adam Birch, Software Engineer, both with Microsoft, as they present Hyper-V Windows Server 2016 Storage QoS and Protocol Updates from the 2016 Storage Developer Conference.
My name is Adam Birch from Microsoft. My erstwhile colleague is Matt Kurjanowicz. We'll be talking about Hyper-V Windows Server 2016, Storage Quality of Service, or Storage QoS, as well as protocol updates to all of the Hyper-V remote storage protocols. So first, we're going to talk about Storage QoS. We'll do a deep dive onto how it works, what are the messages involved, what is the Hyper-V client behavior, and how can you drive the messages in the protocol from the Hyper-V host. After that, Matt is going to go over some of the notable changes in the other Hyper-V protocols, including Hyper-V Remote Storage, Remote Shared Virtual Disk, as well as two new protocol documents, the Virtual Hard Disk V2 and Hyper-V Replica Log formats. So first, what is Storage Quality of Service for? So the scenario we're talking about are virtual machines running any sort of OS or workload running on Hyper-V Windows Server 2016 hosts. This protocol doesn't involve the guest OS in any way, so we're just not going to worry about that for the purposes of this talk. Storage Quality of Service lets you allocate I/O on a per workload business need. So if you have resource-intensive applications, you can make sure they get the performance they need without being impacted by applications that are less business critical. In addition, it reduces the need for over-provisioning storage capacity in order to mitigate the impact of peak demand times. So you can maintain a certain level of performance for all of your workloads, regardless of what other workloads are doing due to peak demand. So what does the protocol do? So the protocol lets you perform several operations. First, you can create a logical flow and associate a handle to that logical flow. So the handles that we're talking about are SMB handles. MSS QoS uses SMB2 as its protocol transport. So whenever I talk about handles, we're talking about SMB handles. And if I talk about FS controls, we're talking about SMB FS controls. A logical flow is a set of I/O that we care about from an initiator to a target. So the initiator, in our case, is going to be a virtual machine, and the target is going to be a remote server or, you know, a set of disks on that remote server, however it's portioned up. So we can create a logical flow and associate multiple handles to that same logical flow using a logical flow ID. We can tag those logical flows with policy IDs or configure a client-defined policy on them. We'll get into that in a little bit. We can provide performance data on the logical flow from the client to the server, and we can retrieve status information about that logical flow from the server, such as, am I actually meeting the quality of service that I asked for? So what is a policy, a QoS policy? So today, the QoS policy is made up of three basic things. The maximum I/O rate, or what we call the limit. This is measured in normalized IOPS, and I'll tell you what a normalized IOP is in a moment. The minimum I/O rate, or the reservation, which is also measured in normalized IOPS. The maximum bandwidth, or the bandwidth limit, which is measured in kilobytes per second. And then, optionally, a policy ID. So this GUID is just a GUID that identifies a policy on a QoS server. This means that it's a server-defined policy. So in the SQoS protocol, you can either have a client-defined policy in which the client says, this is the limit, reservation, and bandwidth limit that I want for this particular logical flow, Or you can have a server-defined policy, where the client sends the GUID representing the policy ID for the policy it wishes to subscribe to. And then the server will respond and tell them, OK, here is the limit and reservation that you're getting at this time. So clients are normatively required to obey the limits of the storage cross protocol. So that means if you tell the client, here's your IO limit and your bandwidth limit, it is not going to issue IO at a rate higher than those limits. And the Hyper-V host will do this. So how you implement the reservation is up to the server. And you know, you can do that in any way. And how you implement the policies, how you manage the server-defined policies, is also up to the server. That is a question outside of the MS-QoS protocol document. So for Microsoft servers, that means we have the, it's a tool in the failover cluster manager, which actually manages the different policies that you can configure. And then their VMs on the Hyper-V hosts can subscribe to those policies. But again, that's up to the implementation of each remote server. It's not a defined by the protocol itself. So normalized IOPS. So if you're in this room for the last talk, you'll know that you saw the curve that she demonstrated about you know, the trade-off between transaction efficiency, you can have lots of small IOs, versus transfer efficiency, where you have large IOs that take a long time. Well, in order to sort of weight those things properly when you're doing quality of service, you don't want to penalize someone who's doing a ton of small IO the same amount that you would penalize another initiator who's doing a ton of really large IOs. Because obviously, you know, if you're doing 2 megabyte reads, those are going to take more time than 1 kilobyte reads. So we don't want to treat those equivalently. So we use this idea of normalized IOPS. So this is just normalized input-output operations per second. So we count in 8 kilobyte blocks. It's kind of hard to see up here, but we have this table is IO size and then the normalized size. So anything smaller than 8 kilobytes is treated as a single normalized IO, and anything larger is divided by 8 kilobytes, rounded up. So 16 kilobyte IO is 2 normalized IOs, 17 kilobyte would be 3 normalized IOs. And this is just an accounting trick to make it possible to balance between these two varieties of workloads. Now, the default is 8 kilobytes for Microsoft servers, but this is configurable in the protocol. And the server tells the client what that base IO size is going to be. And in addition, the perf counters and metrics in Hyper-V hosts are reported, or part of some of them are reported in normalized IO. So you can go ahead and even change that normalized IO size, and you'll immediately see your perf counters change because the division factor has changed. Yes?
You mentioned the server reports to the client, the IO size.
Sorry, say that again?
You mentioned the server reports to the client, the IO size.
Mm-hmm.
How is it reported during negotiations?
So we'll get into the messages in a minute, but as a part of, you know, associate, when the first logical flow is set up, you'll get back the base IO size in the response. But yeah, we'll go into more detail about the actual messages in a few minutes. So as a sort of background for establishing, before we talk about the messages, I want to talk about some example configurations and how that looks within the framework of QoS. So the default policy, right after you create a VM, you get no minimum, no maximum, no bandwidth limit, and there's no policy, which means the policy ID is set to the zero GUID, which is defined as no policy. So you can see here, we have 3 VMs in this chart. And the performance varies, but you'll notice that these 2 more resource-intensive VMs, VMs 2 and 3, are sort of almost starving the third VM. It's getting very little, seeing very little performance. One thing I want to mention, too, is each VM disk will have a unique logical flow ID, and the initiator ID of each logical flow is the VM ID. So In this example, we're considering just a single disk for each of these VMs, but you can imagine that this could even be a single VM with three different disks, and these would all be treated as separate logical flows in QoS. So now we can consider having a minimum configured. So we're guaranteeing a basic level of performance. But there's no maximum, so these disks can get as much performance as possible if the, these virtual disks can get as much performance as possible so long as the remote server is not too busy. So in this case, we've configured a minimum of 200 IOPS, and now the VM1, which is the smaller, the lowest resource-intensive VM, it actually is getting enough performance now, and it's not being starved. You'll also notice that the other VMs have slightly lower performance. That's because they're being limited by the QoS server in order to make sure that the other VM is not starved. So you can also just configure a maximum. So here we are tamping down on these really resource-intensive VMs, and you'll see here also that the third VM that was getting started before still is able to get resources here because the others have been limited to 500 IOPS. You might want to do this if you're providing certain service level agreements and you don't want to allow customers to get more than they've paid for, just for example. You can also configure things into a window. So this gives you more consistent performance. So now everyone is limited between 100 and 200 IOPS in this case. Sorry, I can go back if you want. And then finally, we have the case where the minimum and the maximum are configured to the same value. In this case, customers will see an extremely consistent level of performance, assuming that they're actually generating enough application demand. Now, in the case where the application is not actually generating enough requests, you know, it's not issuing 100 IOPS per second in this particular case, obviously your QoS server can't, you know, provide 100 IOPS per second. So that's one of the challenges of implementing these reservations, is making sure you can distinguish between the case where the server is not providing enough performance and the cases where the application is actually just not demanding enough performance. And that's also kind of a problem for configuring the application. Yes?
So in cases where minimum and maximum configurations are different, how does the server divide the performance after the minimum's
calculated? So the question is, how does the server divide the performance after all the minimums have been met? That is not defined in the QoS protocol. So it's up to your server implementation. I think Microsoft server tends to just try to divide things fairly once minimums are met. But your server could do whatever it wants. And you could even have that a separate feature that is provided in the policy IDs that you specify. OK, so now we're going to get into the actual messages. Conveniently for us, there's only one message, the FS control, storage QoS control. So it has a request structure, which contains information about the policy, as well as perf counter increments. Now, policy information includes, it could be either the limit, bandwidth limit, and reservations specified exactly, or just a policy ID. It's normative for the policy ID to be separate from client configured limits. It can be either one or the other. And then there's a response.
This is per logical flow?
Yes, this is per logical flow. Right. Now, yeah, I'll expand on that in a minute. The response structure contains policy information. So if you are using a client or a server-driven policy, that means the client just says the policy ID to which it is subscribing, then the server will respond and say, OK, here's the limits and reservations that are assigned to you at this time. It also contains a status, which is just, you know, how is this, the logical flow doing? Is it meeting its reservation or not? Is the policy ID one that the server knows about? Because you could, you know, misconfigure it and send the wrong policy ID. And then we have a status code that says, you know, that's unknown. This is a misconfiguration. As well as the time to live structure, time to live field. So this is indicates how long are the policy values valid. So if you have a server-defined policy, you could have that policy change over time or change in response to various workloads. So for in the Microsoft server case, this value is always set to 4 seconds, I believe, which means that after 4 seconds, the client is responsible for querying again what are its new policy restrictions. So this actually leads to some interesting cases where for Microsoft servers, we have this notion of disaggregated and aggregated, I believe, are the terms, where the server policy, you can subscribe to a policy for a set of VMs, say. And that policy can either be every VM gets at least 200 IOPS, or it can be all of those VMs sum to 200 IOPS, say. And that way, if you're using, say, that sum policy, then we'll change the policies that are reported to the client depending on how the other clients are behaving to ensure that everyone meets the right, has the right quality of service that they've asked for. So that's just some of the interesting things that you can do with the time to live and the server-defined policies. So there's 5 different message options, and these message options can be combined. So we'll talk about those. So there's set logical flow ID. This just says, okay, for this handle, I want it to be associated with this logical flow ID. Now, for Hyper-V clients, generally this means you're gonna the case in which you're gonna associate multiple handles with the same logical flow is typically when you have differencing disks, especially in the case of snapshots. So if your VM takes a snapshot, that means we now have a differencing VHDX with the previous one as its parent, and those are both associated to the same logical flow. So the read IO that is going against the parent is still counted against that QoS client. And you can also set is that a question? Sorry. So you can also set policy parameters, which is either the QoS policy ID or the policy parameters itself. You can probe the policy, which means conditionally update the policy, and the logical flow ID. So the client will say, this is what I have right now. This is the logical flow ID that I wanted and the policy parameters that I wanted. Is this consistent with what the server has? And the server will, if it's different, then the server will update it. You can also get status, and you can update counters. So this lets the QoS server have, you know, a better range of information about the storage workloads that are currently happening, which can help you to make better decisions and provide aggregated reporting at the storage server location. Okay, so those are the 5 message options, and these can be combined. So how do we trigger each message? So when you're implementing QoS, you want to be able to know how to actually, you know, exercise the protocol. So to set the logical flow ID, it's pretty easy. You just add a disk to a VM and turn the VM on. So actually, I think I might have left out a step here. It's possible that we don't actually set this unless you actually configured a policy at all. So I might have left out a step. Luckily, I've got that step right below here. So if you want to set a policy, you just use the set VM hard disk drive commandlet. So I provided some PowerShell examples to show, you know, quickly how you can exercise the protocol. So the set VM hard disk drive lets you set the policy parameters of itself, like the limit and the reservation, as well as the policy ID. So for the other messages, these are actually sent all together with the other 3 options specified: probe policy, get status, and update counters. The easiest way to trigger this is to have some sort of workload running in the guest that's generating I/O, and then this message will be sent on the next I/O after the time to live timer expires. So the time to live timer is again the field in the control response structure indicating how long the policy values will be valid. And so after, in the Microsoft server case, after 4 seconds, the client will send another request to make sure everything is still valid, as well as to update performance counters. So this one is easy to trigger. You just run a workload, and it will be triggered after whatever timer you have specified. So the recent updates to MS-QoS in the past year, I believe, are we've added bandwidth limits. Previously, we just had the I/O limits. And we've added a configurable base I/O size, which can now be configured on the server and will be propagated to all of the clients. If you have multiple servers in your setup, it's important that you configure base I/O sizes to be the same so you don't get some confusing behavior. Okay, so that concludes the storage cost deep dive portion, but we can take some questions right now. Yes? Yes.
So this is done on the Hyper-V host side or on the storage server?
Right. So this is these are commands you run on the Hyper-V host side. And this is predicated on the fact that your disk is on your own server, or whatever the server is in this case. So the question was, are these commands run on the Hyper-V host or on the server itself?
Yeah. So is it a client-defined policy in that case, or a storage server-defined policy? Because setting the parameters on the host side.
Right. So in the example I have, setting the parameters themselves, where it says maximum IOPS and minimum IOPS in the setVM hard disk drive. But if you set just a QoS policy ID, then the client will send a message saying, I want to subscribe to this policy ID, which is a GUID. And it's up to the server to know what that is. Yeah. Yes?
If your VHDX is backed by a SAN module, how
right.
do you know the capabilities, the QoS capabilities of that SAN?
Right. So if it's backed by a SAN, so this is SMB is a transport for this protocol. So if you're not using SMB, then it's going to fall outside the parameters of MS-SQoS.
So the server is expected to maintain both counters per logical flow item, right?
Yeah,
how do we query it from the client?
So I don't know if the server is expected to maintain those. I think the client is expected to maintain those. I'm not sure if...
Where do you assign the logical flow ID? Suppose I have three disks associated with
right.
one VM, and I have different flow IDs, and I want to look at the performance of one disk as opposed to
okay.
So how do I?
So the logical flows IDs are actually set to the virtual machine disk ID. It's not the virtual machine ID. It's a disk ID. So it's specific for each disk.
So I can query the performance counters for each specific one.
Right. That's correct. Yes. So the Hyper-V host will report that.
Is there any dependency on the network card on the host, or is it purely done by the Hyper-V host software?
So the question is there a dependency on the network hardware? And there is no dependency. This is purely software. Yeah. So the transport is SMB. So anything below SMB is black magic to us.
So you don't have any current QoS capabilities with the Hyper-V storage stack
itself,
without the backend?
So the Hyper-V storage stack can do limits okay. on its own. And I believe, I'm not sure about the reservations. We used to. I can't remember if it's still there or for now. We've just moved everything to the server backend now. Yeah, but the limits are required by the protocol to be honored by the clients. So we honor them. And that's because it's the easiest place to do the limiting at the client. But, yes?
The policies
are
set per VHDX file, right?
Yes, the policies are set per VHDX file. But you can set the same policy ID on all of those VHDXs if you wanted.
Can you set it to a VM level? We can flow down to a VHDX file?
Not directly, but there's easy PowerShell scripts to do that, for example, yeah. Yes?
A couple things that are worth exploring quickly, right? We've got a test event going on now. Would any of these work if the server were, let's say, your normal Windows 10 laptop? Or these require Windows 2016 only?
So these require Windows 2016.
Okay. So So parts of these you mentioned were added in stages.
Sorry. This will require survey 2016. Sorry, I was quite doubting myself for a second.
We tried the set VM hard disk, whatever.
Right.
You're running Hyper-V from client to client.
Okay.
Running two Windows 10 boxes or whatever just for testing because you had a laptop. This would fail. The set VM hard disk thing would fail.
In R2, for 2012 R2, I believe, we actually, I think we had this commandlet. However, it did not trigger a protocol message because at that time our class implementation was local to the Hyper-V host.
So if we want to experiment with this, the minimum version we should use 2016, sir?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And some of the preview versions, like the preview versions, will have it as well.
Right, but not the 2016 client stuff.
2016 client stuff. That will have it as well, actually. Yes, 2016 client will have it.
Because they're useful to experiment with both.
Right. Yeah. So sorry, I think I misunderstood. The question was, would the Windows 10 clients, for example, have this PowerShell capability? And the answer is yes, it would. You just need to make sure your server is using either has your own QoS implementation or it's Windows Server 2016 or one of the recent previews.
Because Hyper-V would work. Windows client to Windows client.
Right, yes.
And it's a heck of a lot easier to test it that way.
Right. But the QoS capabilities are specific to the back-end capabilities. And what I mean by that is like the QoS server. So like such as defining what this policy ID means is specific to Windows Server 2016. Because that's and for Microsoft Server, it's a feature of Failover Cluster Manager, which is not a client feature.
And that actually brings up an interesting point. For our testing purposes, sure, you can set these things in PowerShell, but you're expecting the cluster manager would do some magic, and there'll be automated stuff in the background that actually does this. Because an admin won't know these values to set, typically.
Right. So if... So the admin's expectation, depending on how you would do it, is either they would know the values to set, or more likely they'll just set this policy ID, which is managed by the storage backend. Yeah. So the policy ID is the more, I think, would probably be the more typical case.
And just to be absolutely clear, there's no point in playing around with this really until you get to 2016, even though there's a subset of stuff that's available for other.
Right. That's correct.
If the server fails to maintain the policy, fails to provide the guaranteed policy, will the client generate an error saying that in the 4 seconds the server failed?
Right, yes. So if the question was if the server fails to maintain the policy, will the client generate an error? Yes, we generate some sort of warning. I can get specifics for you, but. Yes.
The first question is, AWS virtual machine has a feature called the burst IO that it allow you to beyond the maximum limit for duration, and the duration depends rely on the IO credit conception. So do Microsoft have this kind of
Sure. So the question was about AWS Burst IO, which lets you go past the limit. But I misunderstood one part. You said based on the IO.
Credit.
Oh, the IO credit.
IO credit.
Okay. Right. So we don't have a burst feature exactly. However, we do have the case where if say you have a workflow that's been mostly idle for a while and has not met its maximum, because we're averaging things over some time scale, you will get a slight burst as your idle time sort of averages out with your new high activity, and then that should average out to become your maximum value within that time period. Okay, yes?
So going back to the Windows 10 hosting, so if I do this on a Windows 10 client with Hyper-V role enabled,
right.
So only the last step will be a OAuth thing, right? The first two parts will still be honored at the client side.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That includes the min also.
Yes, that includes the limit, yes.
Not the minimum, right?
Not the minimum, because the minimum does not have, it's not enforced here. Yes.
What's the need or what's the use case of having a
bandwidth limit.
Right.
And your IOPS limit is always normalized.
Right. So it just gives you like a finer grain of control. The question is, why do we have bandwidth limit if your IOs are already normalized? It just gives you a finer level of control.
Something more than 8 gig.
Yeah. So, you know, I would argue that, I mean, that's the reason it's a recent update, is because we would say, you know, most of the time you're not going to need to configure a bandwidth limit at all. Just configure your IO limit, which is normalized, and it should work out. But if you have particular workloads, or maybe you're playing around with a different base IO size, the bandwidth limit can be very useful. Okay. So if there's no more questions about QoS, I'm going to turn it over to Matt, and we can always answer more questions as we go on.
Thanks, Adam. So I'm going to quickly go over some of the other updates in Hyper-V remote storage protocols and things that relate to the constellation of protocols that Hyper-V clients would use. We'll start with the biggest changes. The biggest change is that we have some new documents that you might be interested in or may not be interested in, depending on whether it's up to you. One of them is we took our virtual hard disk format, which had been documented on MSDN for several years now, and we made it a supported normative document. It's supported by the Microsoft as a protocol, by our protocol support guys, such as Diane and Tom and other folks in the room, and a plug for them. Like, they're great, and they know our protocols better than we do. It's wonderful. Also, they were running around looking for an adapter for us, so they really are support. I love it. It's awesome. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. So the VHDX is our VHD second version file format. Go take a look. Send us any feedback or any questions you might have about that. In relation to that, we have a replica log file format. This is the format used for the Hyper-V replica feature, which is asynchronous data replication from Hyper-V host to either Azure or to another remote data center. So that's what we do. Why do you care about these? Well, in general, you don't, unless you're going to implement the MS RSVD version 2 stuff that we've been working on and that we're releasing in Windows Server 2016. In those cases, you have to support this concept of snapshots and exporting a snapshot. And RSVD is a wire protocol, and so it doesn't really tell you how you should export these snapshots, right? It doesn't say what they need to be. We'd really like to promote this idea of VHDX and HRL as interchange formats for these types of things, so things that storage vendors understand, especially VHDX. Most storage vendors and cloud vendors already understand it, but since we're referencing it and talking about it, we're bringing it into the normative space. So Windows works better if you use these file formats, but again, it's not a normative must requirement. It's a, you know, it's an option for you. So. Yes.
This is a statement that I'm referring to. It works better when it is.
Yes.
Is it possible that it doesn't go through the same thing? What would better as in like more efficient or better than possible or not possible to serve?
Right. Better is bit of an interesting word here, especially when it's, in this case, some of the functionality doesn't work unless you use these file formats, right? I want to be very careful in bringing a distinction between RSVD and, say, interoperability throughout the rest of the world. RSVD is very specifically a wire format. It says, hey, send a command to the server saying, like, take a snapshot. It doesn't tell you how you should export that snapshot or how you should take that snapshot, because it's just a wire format. Stepping back a level and talking to us saying, well, if I'm going to implement RSVD for Windows Hyper-V hosts, then the whole end-to-end scenario lights up if I use this VHDX thing, which is here in this nice document for you to understand.
And here's the interoperability. So we say interoperability, like someone else's storage and Hyper-V, right? Hyper-V storage, is it what you meant?
I mean, if you've got a Hyper-V host and a non-Microsoft file server.
Okay.
Right? So that's what I mean. Any other questions about that before I go on? No? Okay. I also want to talk a little bit about Hyper-V remote storage, HVRS. I know for some of you, this is the first time you've heard of this. Some of the conversations I've had today, this was new information. Hyper-V remote storage is the document, is a survey document that describes, all right, let's say that you want to interop with a Hyper-V host and you're implementing one of these protocols. Some of them have lots of optional things, like for example, SMB2 has durable handles, and we say not optional if you want to do a Hyper-V host. So that's what it talks about. For example, that under file systems, we talk about, hey, you might be allowed to have sparse files, but for Hyper-V hosts, sparse files are not supported. So that's the purpose of this document. If you're a little bit confused about, hey, I'm trying to make like the best file server I can for Hyper-V to host its stuff on, you also want to take a look at HVRS. There have been some minor tweaks and minor updates throughout it based on feedback we've received from licensees and other folks in the field. So that's what that is. But a plug for this document. Like I said, nothing really hugely significant in the last year or so for this document. We've been making continuous updates based on this. Okay. Talked a little about, you saw this RSVD thing. I've mentioned it. RSVD stands for Remote Shared Virtual Disk. It's a way of taking two virtual machines and pointing them at the same virtual hard drive sitting on a file server somewhere else, and both VMs accessing that at the same time. In Windows Server 2012 R2, we released version 1 of this protocol, which let that happen. In Windows Server 2016, we're implementing version 2 of this protocol. And the biggest differences here are that you can take snapshots. And what is a snapshot? It's a point in time of a disk, right? So you can imagine what we use it for. We use it for backups. So you want to backup a virtual machine, you have to take a crash-consistent point in time that you can copy off somewhere else. That's what these snapshots are. Now you can do it for these shared disks. In Windows Server 2012, you couldn't. So if you implement version 2 of the protocol, that's what you get. Customers like taking backups, so keep that in mind. Also, you can resize these disks while they're online. Customers like being able to make their disk bigger when they run out of space instead of having to take their whole highly available cluster workload offline. So good. Customers want that. Yeah.
Is it fully implemented by 2016
result? Yes. We've stopped making changes for a while, right? If you've been following along, you've seen us come out with a constant series of updates from after Server 2012 R2. We had the Windows, Windows 8, I think, and then Windows 8.1, we released some minor updates because we've been working on this for a few years. And then in the next update and the next update for Windows 10, you've been seeing some of these information leak out over time. Server 2016, this is what we're calling version 2. Okay. Yeah.
So version 4 is some function like snapshotting, but beyond that, like some of the features have been enabled, like migration and resizing of this, which are not enabled in the top R2, maybe for this thing, because it depends on version 1.
Mm-hmm.
Letting stuff be going back into R2, it's functionality back the stream.
Right. We have no plans at this time to backport any functionality to Windows Server 2012 R2 hosts or file servers.
Okay, that you mentioned that with R2 you can migrate to the cloud by doing the log.
Yeah.
Is that the only way to interface with Azure, like, or is that the main way, or like?
So Microsoft has a product suite called, the question is this replicate to cloud the only way to interface with Azure? Microsoft has a product suite to take on-prem VMs and move them to Azure. One of them is by using this Hyper-V replica. You can also take a physical machine to physical to virtual. It'll also do virtual machine to virtual machine in Azure.
One more efficient than the other, or one more encouraged than the other?
I think it depends on what, the question is one encouraged or more efficient? I'm certainly not going to speak from a Microsoft business encouraged standpoint one way or the other, but you can think about perhaps the customer cases that might be there. One customer case is I'm decommissioning a machine in this site and I'm bringing it on to another one. Okay, that's one customer case that our customers want to do. Another case is I have my primary data center here and I just want to rent a disaster recovery site. And so I'm going to use Replicate to the cloud so that I've got an asynchronous replication to a disaster recovery site. But again, that's like really not in scope for what we're talking about here, but just a little bit of context in what customers might want to be doing with these types of features and what a customer might be doing with your file server if they've also got an Azure account.
Does the RSVD protocol respect the QoS settings when multiple VMs are sharing one particular VHD?
and there are conflicting QoS type settings. The previous protocol that he was talking
yes.
about, do they coexist and work well together?
The question is, does the storage QoS protocol and the RSVP protocol work well together? And Adam, do you have an answer for that? We might have to get back to you on that. I know that sounds like an obvious question based on the order of this presentation, but I just want to double check to make sure I'm right before I do that. Any other questions about this? Okay. All right. So I mentioned some protocol updates. In the last year or so, big updates are there's these things called we call them meta operations. This whole snapshotting thing has happened through this meta operation, sort of an internal nomenclature that we've adopted for this. But you can start snapshot, you can export snapshots. There's whole like snapshot stage stuff. I encourage you to go read the document and email our protocol support folks if you have any questions around that. There's also this concept of getting a smallest safe virtual size. So for resizing the disk online or there, there's a new message there. It says it's coming in Windows Server 2016 RTM. We're almost there, I think. Almost. Hopefully at some point we can stop talking about it's coming and it will be there and available in your hands. But it should be available in the latest preview if anybody's doing some internal tap stuff or internal preview type stuff. Windows Server 2016. Any? Okay. I'm going to move on quickly to VHDX. Like I mentioned, what was on MSDN, now it's in normative. I want to be very clear, it does not describe how to relate snapshots to each other. It doesn't describe what SCSI commands you need to implement. In fact, we're never going to, never is a very hard word, but at this point we are not describing in any of our protocol documents the required SCSI command set to make Windows work, in part because we don't know what the guest is. Maybe it's Red Hat, maybe it's Windows, maybe it's something else, and what works best there, I don't know, you have to talk to each vendor. We also don't, in that line, we don't describe SCSI behavior. That's been standardized. Mr. Weber was here earlier today. I'm sure he'll tell you all about required SCSI behavior. They do a great job with all that. It also doesn't describe any extra parser behavior. It's just a file format. And we're also not describing this VHD set concept that we that you might see in Microsoft implementations. We consider that, especially for snapshots in RSVD v2, unnecessary. We think that you should be able to, throughout the protocol primitives, support all those things, and we think that you'll be able to innovate on that more than just following our file format. So I think it depends on what you view your innovation areas in. That's definitely one area you could innovate in while still following our protocol and interoperate. So, okay. So that was a whole lot of what we don't do, but we do describe a file format.
So the VHDS
yeah.
is up to the implementer.
Correct.
How they want to define it.
Yeah, the VHDS is up to the implementer of how they want to define it.
So Microsoft Word interfaces with storage, it doesn't really care as to the format of it or what snapshots there are. It doesn't need to extract the information.
Right. The question is, how does Microsoft interact with it? That's all described in RSVD version 2. Essentially, you can sum it up as how to interact with a set of VHD files.
And right. Did you have to comment that RSVD 2 can crash consistent snapshots?
Yes.
So if they are inconsistent, you could fall back on RSVD. So is that, or what do you think that, what is that?
By that I meant that in the protocol sense, the question is, I mentioned crash consistent. From the protocol sense, we're actually not dictating whether it's crash or application consistent. We're just saying that at that point, it's just a copy. There are some protocol primitives to say, hey, like stop all IOs on this, like I'm freezing all the IOs, and so it plays in well with what we do, but realistically, it's up to the client side to guarantee that they want to stop sending IOs, right? Any other questions? Okay, cool. All right. Most obvious sentence ever. Well, maybe not, I guess. The Hyper-V replica log file format describes a log file used by Hyper-V replica. Sorry about that. Really, that's what it is. Hyper-V replica, I talked about that. This is the log file format for that. Go take a look if you're curious. Again, let us know if you have any questions or feedback. And in general, any other questions or comments? I know we've had a lot so far, but we're happy to answer more.
So any plan to extend QoS beyond Hyper-V?
The question was, any plan to extend QoS beyond Hyper-V? And what do you mean by that?
Let's say for SQL Server, let's say even for general purpose file share level, right? Today it's a group of file handlers that wouldn't be a logical group, right?
Right. So beyond maybe interoperating with other things right there. I can't speak to future product plans. Sorry. Any other questions?
The version 2, right? Mm-hmm. For version 1, so we exercise it, right? The market is going to be shared and you can start exercising it and share it secretly fine amount. The version 2, is there a native application that one can use to exercise that protocol? You know, protocol suite activity?
Right, so the question is, how the heck do I test my version 2 implementation by hooking a Hyper-V host up to it? Well, for one, we will create a VHD set file. Like, we'll ask you to create a VHD set file when you create a shared disk from Windows Server 2016, assuming that you support it. So if you've got a Server 2016 client speaking to a server, your server, you can say, hey, I support version 2, and then we'll go and try to create a VHD set file. By that I mean we'll say, hey, create a VHDX, we'll convert it to a VHD set. So that's how that happens. Beyond that, it's up to some user interaction. So for example, if you want to deal with the log file, the replication, all that stuff, set up Hyper-V replica from one site to another. If you want to start doing backups, do backups. And I'm not sure where at this point in time applications that do backups of guest clusters are at in terms of in the market. I know that Microsoft is working on making sure its product, I think it's DPM, is compatible, as well as third parties are as well. So it's definitely a thing. I just don't know where they line up right now.
So. That's
a great question. I think right now it's up to reading the product docs and being like, hey, does this support Windows Server like guest clustering? Yeah. Any other questions? No. Great. Thank you. Thank you, Adam.
Thanks for listening. If you have questions about the material presented in this podcast, be sure and join our developers mailing list by sending an email to developers-subscribe@snea.org. Here you can ask questions and discuss this topic further with your peers in the developer community. For additional information about the Storage Developer Conference, visit storagedeveloper.org.